This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of March 25th, 2024, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. I hope you're enjoying all of the excitement and rituals of March Madness. Back in 1990, Mark Hardwick had a courtside seat on the Ball State University bench for one of the most memorable games in tournament history. Those were heady times for the redshirt freshman from tiny Dunkirk, Indiana. And a few years later, he would have his chance to start in an NCAA tournament game for Ball State. But it's the former squad from 1990 that came within a basket of defeating one of the greatest teams in college basketball history, and has since been enshrined in the BSU Athletics Hall of Fame. But Hardwick's journey as a distinguished alum continues. In early 2021, he was named CEO of Muncie-based First Merchants Bank after more than two decades as an executive for the institution, including a 19-year run as chief financial officer. Over the course of his tenure at First Merchants, the bank's assets have increased from $1 billion to $18 billion, and its employee base has grown from 200 to 2,100 in its operations over four states. Now, Hardwick has lived the vast majority of his life either in Muncie or just outside of Muncie. But in April 2023, he moved to Carmel. He'll be working out of the new Indianapolis regional headquarters for First Merchants, the former headquarters building of Duke Realty Corp. The bank purchased the building for a bargain, $18 million, after Duke was acquired in 2022. In this week's edition of the podcast, we of course tip things off by talking college hoops and the formative experiences Hardwick now uses to preach business principles to employees. We discuss the philosophy behind buying the Duke building in the Keystone of the Crossing area, and why Muncie remains the bank's corporate home base, although most of the executives work in Indianapolis. And we dive into Hardwick's passions for making lists of his goals and for developing leadership skills both for himself and for bank employees. A couple of quick notes. I interviewed Hardwick 12 years ago when he was named one of IBJ's CFOs of the year, and there are a couple of brief callbacks to that interview. Nothing confusing. Also, I misspeak when I say he was named CEO right before the pandemic. In fact, it was several months after the initial shutdowns, but what he says about how employees responded obviously is still relevant. Here's our conversation. Welcome to the podcast, Mark Hardwick, CEO of First Merchants. Thank you for making time today.
Happy to do it. Thank you for having me, Mason.
As we discussed just a couple seconds ago, I need to apologize right off the bat. You are the CEO of a very important bank, but we're conducting this interview at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 21st, which to me should be a national holiday.
It should be.
The first round of March Madness proper tips off in like less than an hour. My favorite time of year, you were the first person in the history of the podcast that has actually played in the NCAA Men's Championship Tournament. So I got to ask you about it. And not once, but twice. Am I right?
That's correct. My first year, I was a redshirt freshman on the team. And then I guess 4 years later, I actually played and started in the game.
How do you feel at this time of year? I mean, do you flash back at all to Ball State's, the national tournament appearances in 90, which is the most famous, but then again in 93, I believe? Or, I mean, the times you guys appeared in the NIT?
My time at Ball State was exceptional and so much fun, and it was the best time for Ball State basketball kind of in the history of the school. The 5 years that I was there, we won 110 games. So one redshirt year and 4 years of actually playing. And I flash back to Ball State all the time. My employees get sick of hearing it, I think. But it's such a great way to talk about lessons and leadership and what it's like to be a team. And 1990 was incredibly special. So if you go back, that team, the year before, when I was a senior in high school, they were 29-3.
Yeah, they did really well, yeah.
And made it to the tournament. They actually played in Indianapolis at the Hoosier Dome and lost to Illinois, who made it eventually to the final game. I think they lost to Michigan. So I came in as the only freshman on that team, Rick Hall, who is our chairman of the board at Ball State. Rick was the only outgoing senior. And so the team had all kinds of energy and camaraderie and momentum going into that year. And we ended up 26-7 for the year, but it included winning the MAC regular season, the Mid-American Conference regular season, the postseason tournament, and then also, you know, winning two games in the NCAA, where we beat the Pac-10 champs, Oregon State, with Gary Payton.
Right. Gary Payton's last game.
Yes. And then the Metro champs in Louisville with Felton Spencer and LeBradford Smith. And so you think about how talented that team was. And then eventually we played the next game. So those first two were in Salt Lake City. And then we went out to California and played where the Golden State Warriors play, Oakland Alameda Coliseum, and we played UNLV, the eventual champions, and lost kind of on a last-second shot to an incredible team. You remember Jerry Tarkanian was the coach, and then the team included Larry Johnson, Stacy Augman, Anderson Hunt, Greg Anthony, and so it was a really exciting time. And I was down on the end of the bench with popcorn in my water bottle. With a great front row seat. No, not seriously, but it felt that way. Yes.
Yeah. Would you have been like on the scout team for that game? I mean, would you guys have prepared something?
Yeah, I traveled with the team and I was on the scout team running their plays. And that was kind of the role that I played all year, which was a lot of fun. Most of the time I was the other team's best shooter. So it was like a green light every practice to just try to do anything I could to score points on the lead team on the first five.
This is a famous game. I mean, I know a lot of people who know exactly where they were. People who didn't go to Ball State, who know where they were when they watched that game. Because, I mean, defeating UNLV was considered impossible. They were beating teams by like an average of 20 to 30 points a game and did for the remainder of the tournament. To get that close, what was it like for you guys, but then to have to walk away with a loss?
It was hard. It was so much fun, but it was hard because we had the ball down one. And so it wasn't a last second shot that someone made. It was really a last second shot that we missed. And what happened, our best player who hit the winning shot to beat Oregon State, Paris McCurdy, Paris had the ball and slipped. And so the play was busted. And we ultimately didn't really get a good shot up with a chance to win. So we thought we were good enough to beat that team, especially in the moment. And then it would have been exciting. We would have played Loyola Marymount the next game. And that was the year of Hank Gathers. And yes.
Yeah, right. Is that my bias?
No, it was the other guy that shot left-handed free throws to honor Hank Gathers, who passed away. Yes. Yeah.
But Bo Kimble.
Exactly. Right. And they were averaging like 130 points a game, and we were holding people to about 60. And so it would have been a really interesting competition as a way to find out who was going to make it to the Final Four.
So how did Coach get you guys up for that game against UNLV? Obviously, not just the best team that year, but one of the best teams ever.
It didn't take much to get us up for it. It was more about being prepared. We were a team that had very detailed defensive game plans. And it was Rick Majerus was the coach before Dick Hunsaker. And so we had kind of an NBA style or an NBA approach where there were scouting reports on every single player. And back in 1990, that wasn't all that common. Scouting reports on every player, scouting reports with every single play they would run, and incredibly disciplined approach to stopping the other team. So we felt like we were prepared for the game, and obviously we were. We were able to take it down to the wire. But we also had just an array of talented players. If you Google Chandler Thompson dunk, Chandler was our best athlete by far. And there's a play where Chandler jumped over Larry Johnson on a rebound dunk. And it's worth watching. It's one of the best dunks of all time if you check it out. And so we had incredibly senior seasoned players, Billy Butts, who transferred in from Michigan. Paris McCurdy and Curtis Kidd were transfers from Arkansas Little Rock and had played in the tournament their first 2 years at Little Rock. So those guys played in the NCAA tournament 4 years in a row, two at Little Rock and two at Ball State. And it was just a team that believed in themselves.
And that team was inducted into the Ball State Hall of Fame.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, the 90 team.
That was the way I made it into the Hall of Fame.
Maybe you'll get in twice. Maybe you'll be the first guy to get in for two different things. And you just mentioned a few minutes ago, I mean, you have a text thread today with a bunch of the guys on that team.
Yeah, the text thread is so much fun. And it's everything from Paris McCurdy. There was an article written about Paris recently. And in his text, he said something like, hey, when we win, we all win. And when we lose, we all lose. That's the way it was back then. It's the way it is now. You know, it was such a cool text. And then recently, the one that just came out yesterday, one of the guys sent a text that said, hey, make sure you leave room in your bracket for a 9 seed or a 12 seed to do some damage and make some noise in the tournament. And he sent a picture of the team just as a reminder of the noise that we made that year. It was a lot of fun.
You said that you bore your employees with lessons from basketball. Hit me with a couple things that you typically say drawing on your career in basketball.
I have a few. One that I've used a lot is, you know, what happens when you're being pressed? And so you think about a full court press and a couple of guys are coming at you. And there are instincts that are the wrong instincts. A lot of times the instinct is to just put your head down and run hard. And or your instinct is to pick up your dribble or to throw a lob pass over your head. And the right thing that you're supposed to do is to take two release dribbles backwards and then cross over and go another direction. So you think about how many times in business that the pressure is coming at you. And the question is always, how do you respond? And sometimes the right answer is to take a couple of quick retreat dribbles and then change direction and then go full speed that direction. And it's just easy for us to get stuck in the moment and think whatever we were doing at the time is the right thing to do now. And it's smart at times to just gather your head and take a retreat dribble or two and then move in another slightly different direction.
Also, don't dribble into the corner.
Ever.
whatever that means in the business analogy, don't dribble into the corner.
Exactly.
Give me one other.
Caring about one another. The most success comes when you're around people who are selfless. And it's easy in business. It's easy in life to get focused on you. And anytime that you're focused on the person in the mirror, you're not going to be at your best. So I just felt like that we had a team that cared about one another more than they cared about individual success. And that applies so much to business. I think about my executive management team and we talk about team one. We actually use an advisor, Patrick Lencioni, who has written a lot of books. The Advantage is one of them. And he talks about team one just has to be your priority. And team two is the line of business that you run or the administrative function that you run. But team one is the priority. And the question is always, are you willing to sacrifice team two for the good of team one? And my experience at Ball State playing basketball those years, it was so healthy to see what focusing on team one really looked like. And all of us, every single person on that team had to take a backseat personally to the overall success of the organization. And I think it's exactly the same in business.
Now, what was it like to get back to the tournament in 93? And now you're a junior and you have responsibility. I mean, you're going to be on the court 25 minutes a game.
Well, it was fun. We had another great year. We were 26-6 that year, something like that. We didn't go quite as far, but we won the Mid-American Conference. We won the Mid-American Conference tournament. And then we played in the NCAA as a 15th seed, which was kind of disappointing. We had such a great year to be a 15th seed. We didn't feel like we really got the draw that gave us a chance to make a run. And so we played Kansas that year. And if you remember the Kansas team, that in 93, that would have been Rex Walters and Adonis Jordan and Greg Ostertag. I know that same team went on to be a very good IU team as well.
Yeah, I think Alan Henderson was hurt, though.
But yes, yeah. That is true. And so it was fun to be there. I remember just the energy and the excitement. We played at the Rosemont in Chicago. Duke was there as well, so they had a great team that year. And we didn't have the success that we all wanted to have. It was a Roy Williams team, who Roy Williams went on to coach at North Carolina. And he played 12 guys and just wore us out. You know, and we were trying to beat them with 7.
Yeah, sure. So you still watch the tournament. This is still a very important time of the year for you. And then you actually just mentioned where you guys are corporately are having a watch party.
Yeah, we have a new building in Indianapolis. It's our new Indianapolis regional headquarters, the Duke Realty. It was originally their headquarters. that they didn't really even move into. They sold to Prologis and it sat empty for a few years. So we're having about 250 clients in today. We're having a big watch party and it'll be a lot of fun. But I stay close to NCAA basketball. I'm a big fan of a number of teams. You know, I grew up with Matt Painter. We're the same age, played on the same AAU teams. We played against each other in sectionals. We used to hang out together a lot. So I'm really excited for his success. I've enjoyed watching him. I'm rooting on Purdue hard. And then I actually have a home in South Carolina and I know the Clemson coach pretty well. And so I'm excited about seeing how they do. They're a sixth seed and I've been to four of their games this year, actually.
You have Purdue winning the enchilada.
I do have Purdue winning the whole thing.
Okay. You're a brave man.
I'm a believer.
That's exactly right.
They're better this year. They've made great strides. I'm excited about it.
They are. And they don't fold in tight games, which is, I mean, an incredible lesson. I mean, they really keep their heads up.
Their guards this year are stepping up when it's really needed once ED is triple teamed.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm, with more than 800 attorneys in 8 primary Midwest markets and the District of Columbia, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast and my conversation with Mark Hardwick, CEO of First Merchants Bank.
I mean, you were First Merchants' Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer from 97 to 2020 and became CEO in January 2021. Like, Central Indiana is not like the banking capital of the Midwest, but there are opportunities to go other places. Why did you want to stay with First Merchants?
I've joined First Merchants in 97 and I was only out of school, I guess, 3 years. And I remember telling my wife, hey, this is an opportunity that if it lasts 5 years, I started as corporate controller, it will have been worth it. And now 27 years later, you know, I'm still here. And I kind of bleed First Merchants black and gold. May sound like I bleed Purdue black and gold, as excited as I am for this tournament. But we ended up moving to Muncie. We raised our children in Muncie. I've had a career that I'm really proud of in Muncie that's been incredibly gratifying. And every year, as we looked forward at what we thought First Merchants could accomplish, I was always excited about what I thought the next year would bring. And for the most part, it has. At the time when I started in banking, there were about 12,000 banks in the United States. There are only 4,000 today. And little First Merchants that's headquartered in Muncie, Indiana, actually is number 70th in the whole country in terms of total size with $18 billion of assets. And we have 2,100 employees spread out across 4 states. And I just feel like we have the opportunity to make a difference. There is a void. There's a customer group that we think we can serve better than the bigger banks. And our vision statement that we put in place when I became CEO is to enhance the financial wellness of the diverse communities we serve. And when I look back over the years with leadership, John Maxwell always talked about his personal mission statement was to be significant in the lives of others.
I'm sorry, was that the former CEO?
No, John Maxwell is an author of a number of books and does a lot of leadership work. And to be significant in the lives of others is his personal mission. And for me, I just wanted something very similar to be our vision statement or our mission statement. And so to enhance the financial wellness of the diverse communities we serve is how we show up every day. And we think we can create an environment where people can grow and be their absolute best and make a difference in the world by sharing the financial knowledge that we have.
When you were CFO, I mean, you were involved, obviously, intimately in the growth of the bank. And you mentioned the consolidation. Was that mainly through acquisition that you're able to grow?
It's kind of a mix. You have to grow organically and you have to be efficient. So those are the two things we always prioritize. If you grow organically in the mid to high single digits and you have a 55% or so efficiency ratio, which would be like a 45% operating margin, then you really kind of control your own destiny. You typically will trade as a public company with multiples that are higher than your peers. And if that happens, then you have the currency to be acquisitive or active in M&A. And so during my 27 years here, we've acquired 17 institutions, different banks around those really three states, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan.
I think you said earlier you had 2,100 employees now?
We do, yes.
That's right, in four states.
When I first joined the bank in 97, the bank was $1 billion in assets and made $11 million and had 200 employees. And so now it's $18 billion. We made about $220 million last year and 2,100 employees.
When we say assets, I'm assuming that's deposits and what else?
In a bank, the asset side of the balance sheet is made up of loans and fixed assets and investments. You know, so, and then the liability side are really all deposits. So,
oh, okay. See, the assets are all loans.
Assets are all loans.
And your investment holdings.
Yes. And then the liability side are all the deposits that we gather. And that's how we have the capital or the funding to make the loans.
Was there a moment when you became CEO where you were like, oh, I kind of wish I hadn't done that when I was the CFO? Did you have any issue with the job that the previous CFO did?
That's funny. I don't know if there was anything strategic that I felt that way, but I absolutely feel that way just with attitudinally. You know, it is so easy to see opportunity and to press hard for that change to happen on a time frame that you want. And the thing that as I continue to mature through the business, and especially as CEO, you realize, hey, all of those things may be right, but there's a time for everything. And I was aware enough years ago, I started making lists of what are the top 10 things I'd like to see different in the company. And what I found is that when I went back to look at it 5 years later, 80% of them were finished, and the other 20% I was wrong.
Okay.
And so just trying to have enough patience to say, you know, part of being great is always to want to push the company or the organization forward. But you have to also just balance a desire to be great and the timing of what really fits the organization.
I don't want to put you through any post-traumatic stress problems, but you became CEO just in time for the pandemic.
Yes, I did.
Obviously, we're very familiar with the company, but how did that affect the learning curve that you were going to have as CEO, or did it?
Oh, I think the thing that it did that I'm really happy about, it just helped me focus on whether our employees are executing and delivering and doing their jobs. And I care less about how they do it, which is really healthy. In our organization, when we talk about the vision statement, which I mentioned, enhancing the financial wellness of the diverse communities we serve, but we also say, and if you believe in our vision and our mission, and you care about people or you love people, you're welcome here, and then bring your whole self to work. And it's an environment where we're trying to create, everything doesn't have to look the same. Our people, our products, how we do our jobs, even how we dress, doesn't have to be exactly the same. And we're kind of a remote, not remote work entirely, but we're like 3 days in the office, 2 days out is generally how we function. And I just think what happened during the pandemic, everyone that was working from home proved to all of us that they took their job seriously and they were willing to execute at a really high level. And they didn't have to be sitting at a desk with a supervisor monitoring all of their daily activities. So it's created a culture that is, oh, I just think, very open and comfortable with doing things differently versus kind of the old school manufacturing mindset about how you go to work.
So you're not trying to go back to 5 days in the office. You're comfortable with 3 and 2.
Yeah, I am. And it's interesting. The culture kind of drives people to be here more frequently than that even. You know, I mentioned this office, we have 175 of our 2,100 employees that are moving into this new Indianapolis regional headquarters. And we ultimately looked for this building because we were busting at the seams in the leased facility we had off of Meridian and 465. And we were busting at the seams because people are in and they loved to work closely with their colleagues and to learn and to collaborate. And so this space is a very collaborative kind of working space. And I think our employees love the flexibility that if they have a reason they need to work from home, that they can.
Yeah. And obviously, this is a fresh. Yeah. This is like right out of the box. I've unboxed the largest Apple product in history. I mean, it is very modern. It's, you know, it's all Windows. And I mean, this in a way is another way of retaining employees, I assume, is to give them a really modern space. Where at Keystone of the Crossing, you're surrounded by amenities. So did that all make the move worth it?
Yeah, that was part of what we were looking for, was an appealing space, not only to work in, but also to have access to amenities in the area. I have one of my executive vice presidents is recruiting for a key position, and he had an employee who's in Minneapolis say, you know, I think we're going to stay here. I'm not really willing to move. They had a parent that was having some health issues, and then they saw the building and they've changed their mind. And they said, you know what? We've decided we are willing to move. You know, I'm going to bring my dad with me. And it's just amazing how from a retention and recruitment perspective, I think it's going to make a big difference.
This didn't come free. You had bought it for $21 million?
Yeah, it was in that ballpark. I think Duke Realty built the building and furnished it for about $43 million, and we bought it for a little less than half.
And then how much did you put into making changes for yourself?
We really haven't yet. I mean, what you see, this is what it looks like. So we're going to paint a few things. They used a green color, and it's throughout the building if you look closely. So we're going to make some changes and make sure that the inside of the building, you know, looks like First Merchants. And then they also had some spots where there were a ton of filing cabinets that we just don't use. And so we've removed the filing cabinets and we've put in more working space and kind of commuter space in those locations. But that's about it.
So it's just a lucky happenstance that the Duke would be acquired.
It was.
With a brand new headquarters building.
Yeah. When we were ready to look, happened to be available.
So are you going to work here? Are you going to work out of Muncie?
I moved here in April, actually moved to Carmel from Muncie after raising our children. And so we have a large percentage of our executives are in Indianapolis. And I just felt like I had to be here on a regular basis. And yet in Muncie, which is still our headquarters location, that entire main office building is full. And our Daleville Operations Center that's in Delaware County has 425 people that work there. And so our commitment to Muncie, Delaware County is still really high.
What they say happens when executives don't work at the corporate headquarters is people get afraid that they're just going to lose sight of like the home city, and that they're going to lose sight of, you know, the concerns and needs of the employees that still work out there and the needs of the city. How do you address that?
I've been incredibly ingrained in Muncie, Delaware County for a long time. And the only reason I really moved, I put 55,000 miles on my car in a little over a year and finally just said, I can't spend my life in a car. But I'm on the board of trustees of Ball State University. I'm on a group called Next Muncie that includes the mayor, the president of the university, the president of the hospital, and we're actively involved in trying to move strategic community initiatives forward. Actually, I just accepted a position to be on the board of the George and Francis Ball Foundation in Muncie. I'm incredibly engaged, and I feel like it's a community that needs leadership. It has a lot of great leaders, but when they've called on me to help, I've been willing to jump in. I'm excited about what's happening there. I recently ran the capital campaign, was co-chair of a capital campaign to raise $33 million for a new YMCA. That is actually in the process of being built on Muncie Central's campus. So if you remember when Muncie Central High School, the school district, was having trouble, Ball State, the state appointed kind of Ball State to pick the board. And so Ball State's actively engaged in that community and how the school system works. The YMCA is now being built on the high school's campus, which is such a unique situation. And from an economic development perspective, the community is actually on fire. It's in a positive way. Lease occupancy rates in Muncie are 98% occupied downtown. And so there's housing is the biggest problem that the community has. There are only 100 homes for sale in the entire county. So there's opportunity for economic development to come into the community, but the housing is its biggest challenge at this point.
You're in the business of mortgage loans. I would assume that's a problem.
Yes, it is. Construction costs are so high, and the community just has there's still a median income differential between what people earn and what it takes to get into a new home, and trying to find ways to fix that gap.
And this is a problem. I mean, obviously, we're monitoring all across central Indiana. I mean, the number of of existing homes that are sold, I mean, continues. I think it's some stat, I think is year over year, it has decreased for the last 25 months.
Some of that is interest rates, but if you go back to 2008 and 9 during the Great Recession, the great financial crisis, I forget the number of homes that were built throughout the United States, but the next decade, we built 10% of the homes that we did the prior decade. And so it's become a real supply problem. And higher interest rates have recently have created challenges as well with mortgages.
One more thing about headquarters. The leadership team is here. How does Muncie maintain what you would consider the corporate headquarters?
Mostly from related to our staffing, I would say 80% of our human resource function is still housed in Muncie. About 80% of our finance team is housed in the Muncie location. About 80% of marketing. And then even like the private wealth operations team is all there. And in Delaware County, our Daleville Operations Center, with all of our loan ops and deposit ops and IT and cybersecurity, all of those functions with 400 plus people are in that headquarters or that location.
How many people is that total employer-wise?
Oh, it's 650 or so.
Okay.
Yeah, of the 2,100.
You grew up really close.
Right? I did.
I mean, you really have not a criticism. You have not moved very much.
No,
over the course of your life. I mean, what I forget the name of the town you grew up in.
It's Dunkirk, Indiana.
Dunkirk, right. Currently, about 2,100 people. I assume when you grew up there, it was less.
Well, it's been about the same size.
Okay. Yes. Well, there you go.
An old glass factory town. Kerr Glass, Indiana Glass. And my dad was the local barber for more than 50 years. My mother was the secretary of the elementary school. And it's really fun to just look back and think about where and how we grew up and where I am today. And I have a book. I keep a list of all the people that have had the most influence on my life. And to go back and review those names and to look at the impact they've had on me is something I enjoy doing. And every time I add a new name to the list, I go back and review all of them again, just to think about a young person growing up in a town like Dunkirk can end up, you know, where I am.
You are super intentional about making lists. When did that start?
I don't know. It's got to be the small part of being an accountant that's still part of who I am.
I mean, but it sounds like from a pretty early age, I mean, you were cataloging and making lists and thinking about leadership and success.
I've been very intentional. I was the first person on either side of my family to go to college. And I remember, you know, just the effort of being intentional that, hey, I want to go to college. I was inspired that that was the right next thing for me by a handful of people that I was close to. I remember at the time thinking the only way that could happen was if I had an athletic scholarship. And just to be goal-oriented and working towards something better than where I was at the time.
So as a kid, you were hooping it up and you were, you know, going up against Painter and yeah. Just all these guys from the area. But at some point, you made a calculation in your head, I need to be better because I want to get a scholarship.
It was 100% of the focus. I was good academically, and I thought my way to an education was going to be through athletics.
That's amazing. And it worked.
It did. I had lots of cool options. It's hard for people to believe this, but I had three offers before my senior year. And one was the University of Maryland. The other was Stanford University.
You were got to be kidding.
Yeah, I know.
That's amazing.
It is kind of amazing that offer even happened. And Barry Collier was the assistant coach. So, you know, Barry Collier, yeah, right. The athletic director of Butler, former basketball coach. He was the assistant basketball coach at Stanford and found me somehow. And I made my visit and there was an offer. And then I ultimately chose Ball State. And I know it left a few people scratching their heads, but it just felt like it was where I was supposed to be.
I mean, were you one of the guys who just liked to be close to home?
Yeah, I guess. I always joke. My dad doesn't like this joke, but it was funny. I'd been in three states, you know, until I was being recruited. We lived in Muncie, or we lived in Indiana. My grandparents lived in Ohio, and my dad loved the Reds. And every time we would go to a Reds game, or once a year, we would cross the bridge to Kentucky. So, yes, I've always been close to home.
That's amazing. That's all like within like 60 miles. Well, maybe a little bit to get to the Red Stadium. Just to finish up a little bit on leadership, just to kind of echo a theme. As I recall from the interview that we had 12 years ago, when you were CFO of the year in your category. You have a very intentional mindset towards leadership, not just for yourself, but for other people. I mean, it's almost evangelical. And I mean, and not necessarily like in the Christian sense, but not necessarily excluding the Christian sense. How do you like to propagate leadership principles for people that work here?
Being a public company, from a faith perspective, it has to be very kind of interfaith oriented. And we actually just started a new interfaith employee resource group that we announced today, which is really cool. So we have a people of color resource group and a women's group, a veterans, a pride resource group. And we just introduced this new ERG that's an interfaith resource group. And I'm really excited about it. I think to be a spiritual person matters for me. I am a Christian. I've been incredibly involved in my church for years. And I do believe that being a faithful steward of your gifts, talents, resources, and abilities and blessings that God puts in your life is what we're called to be. So when I talk about leadership, I oftentimes internally talk about being a faithful steward. And it's easy to discuss that in a way that says your life matters and your work matters. And you have a destiny to fulfill. You have gifts, talents, and abilities that you should feel some obligation to maximize. And how do I help you? Inside our organization, we think about having a growth mindset all the time, and that you've never fully arrived, and there's an opportunity to be better tomorrow. And from a leadership standpoint, I feel like if I find a way to push people to maximize their potential, then there's not much else that I have to do. The vision of the company, the direction we're going, all of those things are going to take care of themselves if we have people that come into this building and come into all of our locations focused on the customer and focusing on trying to be the best person they can be.
What does push mean, though? Because you could push them by saying, okay, well, I expect to see you here at 8 o'clock every night. Yeah. Or is there another way to develop their talents and their productivity without doing that?
I want it to be an internal drive. And I've always thought these opportunities, when I look back on my life, it's pretty simple, like the formula. And I share it at times. I showed up, I gave it everything I had, and then doors opened. So if you show up, you just do the right thing, you work hard, you try to learn, you make a difference, and a door is going to open. And it takes some discernment. Is this the right door? But the second step of that is you have to have courage to step through that door and tackle the next challenge. And what I think winners learn is that when you step through that door, a lot of the skills and abilities that you've already developed will help you be successful in this new endeavor. And so even though geographically I haven't moved far, I think about all the doors that I've had the courage to walk through. Being CFO of the company when I was 31 years old, I remember telling the CEO, I'm happy to take on the challenge, but I have no idea what I don't know. And I remember his response was, I believe in you, I trust you, and I've got your back. And I stepped through that door and just got busy, started working hard. And the same thing goes for going from high school to college or from the first job to the second job. And as I've progressed through the organization, the opportunity to be CEO is the same kind of thing. Hey, I have a lot of skills and abilities, but I also assessed all the things that I thought I needed to be better at. And am I a good enough public speaker? Am I good enough? Can I motivate? Can I inspire? Can I win the hearts and minds of our people? Can we convince shareholders that we're going in the right direction? And all of those things, I just continue to work on them and try to make them better. And I did ultimately step through that door, had the courage to do it. And after this, I guess this is my fourth year of working hard, I feel great about where we are and the direction the company is heading.
So if I work here and, I want to get those skills too, can you help me get those?
Yeah, we have career development plans that are littered throughout the company. And it's kind of a employee first type of thing. You take it, you fill it out, you lay out the vision that you have of where you'd like to go next. But we have mentors and we have ways to connect you with the resources that you need. So we're trying to ask our employees to be very proactive about their career. But we're also surrounding them with the resources to help them get where they're trying to go.
Well, we'll have to check in a couple of years and see how that goes. But hey, thank you for taking so much time to explain this to me.
That's been fun.
And boiler up. My thanks again to Mark Hardwick. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are some stories in the latest issue of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Purdue University has its sights set on turning some mostly undeveloped land on the northeast portion of IUPUI into the heart of its new Indianapolis satellite campus. But its aspirations go well beyond the real estate. Mickey Shuey outlines the plan to draw more students interested in engineering and business, including through new degree programs. Also in this week's issue, Daniel Bradley serves up the story of a Mexican restaurant group in Fishers that already has 15 locations. And Susan Orr explains how local businesses are preparing for the inevitable disruptions that will come with the solar eclipse on April the 8th. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.